Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
You're listening to Double Feature.
I'm sorry. I thought this would be great.
This is your fault.
I know.
What the fuck did I just watch?
Two things.
That's what I want to know.
Two things I want to say here.
Am I going to learn that within the next 49 minutes?
Nah. So the films today. Hi, this is Double Feature.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. My name is Michael. I'm here with fucking some bullshit, Eric 13. And we're doing two films today. One is A Tale of Two Sisters, which is one of our Kickstarter recommendations.
It's not, actually. Which makes this even more psychotic.
So we're pairing it with Calvaire. The American title is The Ordeal, which I had suggested we pair with A Tale of Two Sisters, as Tale of Two Sisters was sitting on our pairing list on the block.
It was rotting on a block after 7 years of going, should we do Tale of Two Sisters?
Yeah, so...
let's keep that on the block.
This wasn't the movie I thought it was.
Tale of Two Sisters wasn't?
Calvaire.
Oh, well, that worked out fine anyways.
It worked out fine. It was a movie that I had seen, but I was thinking of a movie called Calgary.
Oh.
I just wanted to let people a little bit behind the scenes know that we have absolutely no fucking idea what's going on our own show. And we just say titles and assume that that title is a movie.
Yeah, right.
And then look
and
it
then
up
scramble
later.
To find some movie called that and watch it.
Exactly.
So if you want to compare this to another nutty fucking show, we did Joyride and the Attic Expeditions on year one this time.
Joyride, definitely in my top two J.J. Abrams films.
I think I have less of an idea what the fuck happened in the Attic Expeditions after we talked to Jeremy Kasten about it. I don't know if that's possible. Do you remember the moment on the, okay, so we're talking about year one. You can get these remastered year one shows on Amazon, on iTunes, Apple Music. They're in a lot of wherever fine musical and spoken word tracks are sold. You'll find us in the spoken word tracks. That's where we would be.
Right.
That's how I smuggle our show into legitimate stores, just by it's beat poetry. It's 53 hours of beat poetry. Go back and listen to this fucking show. I know sometimes I come on here and I'm like, wow, that was a weird show. Go hear it. It's kind of funny. But this show, first of all, it's when we still had guests. So that's weird. Secondly, the guest is Jeremy Kasten, also fucking weird. So we come on the Attic Expeditions and in advance, we record a full-on explanation. We dig in. You know, year one, we would not accept what the fuck happens in this movie. I don't know. Anyways, what's coming up next time? That was not okay. So we couldn't leave the fucking table until we had solved the Attic Expeditions. And we talked round and round in circles and poked it apart, and we got pretty close. And then we recorded an interview with Jeremy Kasten. And I thought that he could confirm our theory. And we start laying out these pieces and asking questions. And I don't know if you remember, but there's a distinct moment where I ask him what's going on in the film. And there's a long pause. And he goes, yeah, I don't know. That's literally a moment in the show. And it's amazing. We have to catch up on some stuff, my friend. I have come back from Utah and I bring news to you.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not half as self-indulgent as the news I was planning to bring to you.
Oh, good.
So there are three film festivals going on in Utah.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Cat Dance, which is why I went there. But two lesser known festivals, or I should say less important festivals, called Slam Dance and Sundance.
Uh-huh.
First of all, let me tell you the reality on the ground there. It's Sundance.
Yeah.
Slam Dance and the thing you've never fucking heard of, Cat Dance, I believe they both occupy one building that hasn't been rented out for Sundance, or like across the street from each other.
This kind of sounds like South by Southwest.
Right. When South by Southwest happens, do you have, you know, South by South something else? Kitschy?
Oh, yeah. South by San Jose, South by, yeah, all that shit.
Well, it's even trickier there because everybody knows Cat Dance is not part of Sundance.
Right.
But South by is just what people call South by Southwest. Mm-hmm. So if you say South by San Jose, then people go, oh, it's the San Jose division of South by. Right, clearly. Right. This is highly official. This is very on the up and up. So I went there to see Director's Cut, which I actually don't even want to talk much about.
Okay.
The cast was there. Rifkin was there. I got to hook up with the DP and his wife, not in the way I wanted, but in the, just a lot of great people and a lot of great people I haven't talked to in a long time. It was really weird because it's a movie about the actors.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of beat the crap out of Harry Hamlin in the movie.
Uh-huh.
There's just, as the voiceover got rewritten more and more, it just became digs at how terrible and ugly and awful Harry Hamlin is, which he didn't really know was coming, which is funny. So I sat over with him, Missy, and Teller, and to hear the variety of reactions, because it's basically a blowjob for Missy Pyle for an hour and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And to hear the things she was very embarrassed by, or the things that made her stand and cheer, it was just a very amusing time. Everybody will know all about that. The thing that people weren't talking about and totally threw me off, and I haven't talked much about, is Rob Zombie's film 31.
Yeah.
Now, when I went there, I didn't know how big of a deal this was going to be because the people around me were all in Director's Cut. They talk about it all the goddamn time. It's everywhere on the internet. Adam already had, you know, 20 different articles in every fucking magazine ready.
Uh-huh.
And every horror blog and all these things. But 31, I mean, every once in a while, Rob Zombie's like, yo, check out the screenshot. And that's pretty much all you get. So 31 opened the Sundance Midnight films.
Mm-hmm.
I believe. Actually, there might have been one the night before I was there. I don't know. You know, I went and just looked at the two movies I had something to do with.
Yeah.
And ignored all the other movies.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the most self-indulgent way.
That's how you do Sundance. Yeah, that's how you do South By.
I think you're supposed to ski in there as well.
Oh, yeah.
But no, I just went to see things that I had executive produced. And I stayed past my name in the credits, so I should be given a little credits for that.
Opening credits or closing?
Opening on both movies. Now, I knew that was coming. Let me tell you, when that happened in 31,
yeah,
I lost my goddamn mind in that theater. So I was totally wrong. I walk into, first of all, the 31 ticket line had 1,000 people in it.
Yeah.
It was nuts. Secondly, to once again reaffirm how much I had to do with 31, I had to purchase my own ticket.
Right.
And third, it cost $20. And let me tell you, I'll be writing a letter to the Zombie family about that.
Yeah.
The amount of people that are there, it's one of the largest theaters I've ever been in my entire life. It's like the WWDC theater when Apple would do the, or I guess still does the, I don't know why I speak in past tense about that, strangely. They'd unveil an iPhone or whatever. And the theater seats 1 billion people.
Right.
That was the theater showing 31. And as you go in, they're handing out
face masks.
Masks, yeah. Of characters.
Right.
Yeah. From the, you've seen these.
Yep.
It's amazing because it seems so much less sterile than the rest of Sundance.
Sure.
It becomes a metal show.
Yeah.
For just a couple hours.
Yeah.
Whereas everybody else has flannel and glasses on at all the other movie premieres.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt at home with my people. And I have to tell you, man, that movie fucking rocks.
Yeah.
I'd say it's the greatest movie zombies made since Devil's Rejects.
Wow. That's what I was hoping for.
And I think in a lot of ways, it's a lot more Rob Zombie than Devil's Rejects is.
That's good. There's definitely this opinion of the Devil's Rejects, which is along the lines of the Devil's Rejects is Rob Zombie's most normal movie.
Yeah. And it, you know, it's got its brutality to it. But as we saw the other zombie movies that came out afterwards, it's clear that he's interested in a whole other.
Sure.
I mean, he wants Vanishing Point without the cars.
Right.
He wants, you know, hostile levels of gore and violence.
Right.
And to some degree, I feel like Rob always gets fucked on his final cuts.
And this time is no exception.
Well, we talked about that a little bit. And he doesn't think it matters.
Yeah.
He thinks the movie is perfect.
That's good. Yeah.
Well, you know, there's an article that came out recently that some cuts were made so it could be rated R
instead of
rated NC-17.
Right.
And he was basically just like, look, what do you want? An NC-17 movie doesn't fucking stand a chance of going to a theater. So here's the four things we cut out. This scene was longer. This scene was longer. This scene had a twist with the knife in addition. And this scene was longer. And so nothing's really left out of the movie.
Right.
I definitely squirmed so long at all four of those scenes that I had to turn away anyways. So it's really, I mean, the pacing's just fine. But God, it is fun and humorous, which I didn't expect. Gory as fuck. Over the top as fuck. Malcolm McDowell is as ridiculous as possible. I mean, everybody's been comparing it to the Running Man, but it's really a lot more like a Rob Zombie Hunger Games.
Yeah.
And it's just fucking amazing. I about lost my mind just being in the credits of that movie because of how good it was.
Yeah.
I felt like there must have been some mistake.
Yeah.
Because it starts really strong too.
Sure.
Right from the opening, you're like, oh fuck. This is,
yeah,
this is going to be way good. And then it's like, boom, and my name comes up. It was so fucking cool. So that was Sundance. Zombie thinks that 31's coming out in like 6 months or something.
Yeah.
It's probably going to do an iTunes VOD thing.
Sweet.
So yeah, I wanted to come bringing tidings of Hooray Zombie.
Yeah.
Because just as a fucking fan.
Right.
I thought it was great and intense and just felt like the most pure Rob Zombie, the most pure Rob Zombie I've ever seen.
That's awesome.
All right.
So all that said, spoilers about to happen.
Let's talk about A Tale of One Sister. Ah, I've already spoiled it.
There it goes. There you go.
I've already fucked up the show.
Well, yes and no, because there are still two sisters. So I don't know which one you're spinning the tale about.
It turns out both sisters have tails. That's the spoiler.
Right.
You should have skipped. Yeah. I'm sorry. Can we talk about the infamy first?
Yeah.
This was sitting around for a long time. I'd never even seen it.
I'd seen it a couple times. And that's probably why it lived on that list for so long.
I mean, I feel like every time I talk to people about, it's the type of things not to just fucking throw another foreign movie on there, but lists that have Old Boy on them,
mm-hmm.
or lists of really gut punchy foreign horror movies, this always shows up.
When it comes to foreign extreme films,
mm-hmm.
I feel completely different about the Asian extreme movies than I do the French extreme movies. With the French extreme movies, aside from one film that you continually try to shoehorn onto the show, I pretty much am just game for all of them. I think they're all great. They all have their own moments.
I know which one that is.
And I think that they're all awesome and unique and original. With Asia extreme, and I think there's a good reason for this, I feel like it's a lot harder to find gems.
It is, yeah.
I feel like you have your Old Boys and you have, I mean, my personal rock star of the genre is going to be Tokyo Gore Police for sure.
Well, there's also, yeah, there's also as a genre, I think that's a whole gem, the whole,
yeah.
All of them.
But I feel like because of the breadth of the Asian extreme genre versus the French extreme, because I mean, Asian extreme, you're talking about at least six countries, mm-hmm. if not more, making films.
Mm-hmm.
By that regard, just the sheer number of extreme Asian movies, the fact that they're, you know, there's a Tartan Asia Extreme is just a production house.
Yeah.
They just make crazy Asian movies.
Right.
Tale of Two Sisters kind of veers away from just straight extreme and way more into the horror camp.
Right. It dives way more into the last 12 minutes of high tension. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah. I don't know when to address that. I'm going to just keep making jokes about it, maybe rather than get into it. We'll get there.
Yeah.
So we finally come around to this movie, which everybody's been saying, God damn it, you should see. And I also partially blame that on the iconography on the cover. And I know that for some people in the United States, it has to evoke The Shining just a little bit.
Yeah.
It has to.
Yeah.
But stylistically, I mean, it does, you know, it definitely does its own thing. And the technique of this film is something I took really particular note of. The whole movie's locked off. I mean, it's very rare that the camera is, you know, handheld or in motion at all, if not straight on a dolly. You know, things move immediately forward and backwards if they don't just sit on objects.
Mm-hmm.
When they push in incredibly slowly, and you can get away with an extremely long take because you know, there's motion in the camera concentrating on this thing and you just start getting so fucking close to it and you're, it's a shout at the film. I think there's right. a lot of moments where you're like, would you just fucking open that door or go under that thing or whatever you're doing there? And it's also, you know, really crushed black. So it's a lot of the movie is just in sheer blackness. You just don't know what's back there. And you don't know what kind of crazy route the movie's going to go down.
Right.
I'll tell you one thing. Watching this, it doesn't seem like the kind of world you would see a CG creature in.
Definitely.
So I know whatever the fuck we're getting, it's going to crawl around upside down with its hair over its face or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's using a lot of those, I mean, the good old well-knowns. And they're working. They should be funny, but a creaky door, right?
Right, right.
I mean, a fucking, you know, ghost wind.
Yeah.
It's out of Hammer horror movies, and it's making it fucking scary.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's why it's well-known. I think it's well-known for its crazy plot, but I don't think it has anything to do with the technique, which I right. thought was pretty fucking awesome.
Well, so the plot is definitely one of the things that I feel like, so this is a perfect example of when I feel like a film has it all together. So the idea of a twist in films, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a much disputed aspect. Some people think of it as a device. Some people think of it as a cheat. Some people think of it as a tool. And I can understand all the ideas, like all the disputes about how to use a twist when you're making a movie.
Sure.
People will call M. Night Shyamalan out for this. I won't for every movie, but it's definitely the case in a couple of his films where the movie is basically useless if there isn't a twist. There's nothing special going on except the twist changes everything in a way that makes the movie good, right?
Right.
And that's probably a weak use of the device. And in this movie, it feels like they have everything together. They know exactly what they want to do. And somebody somewhere went, well, what's the twist?
Yeah.
Because it's a compelling plot knowing the sister is dead.
Sure.
That's a compelling aspect to the narrative here. Because I will definitely say the second time I watched this movie is way more enjoyable than the first time.
Yeah, totally.
Watching it the second time knowing the sister's dead, it really is the kind of movie that could be a near perfect film moving that quote twist up to like a pre-credits.
Yeah, it's a great exercise to take twist movies and go, if the twist was revealed immediately, what's going on in the movie? What's left?
Right.
Seeing the madness of the sister,
mm-hmm.
you know, and how she's haunted and the things she's haunted over and how they call back to exactly what it is, I think is still, you know, there's a great moment when you see the event that takes place
mm-hmm.
and you see the tiny hands trying to get out from under the closet.
The wardrobe, yeah.
And they're scratching, trying to get out. And it's just like the scratchy ghost hands.
Right.
And you go, oh, because they are being haunted specifically by the vision of the thing that they saw, not just they got fucked up and now there's monsters in the house. I think that works just as well if you are to reverse it, show that scene in the beginning, and then you're looking out in the whole movie trying to see if a ghost hand is going
right.
to fucking, it might even be more effective. Every little crack you see, you're going, is there a ghost hand in there?
And one of the biggest strengths of the movie, which is that the stepmother is the fucking worst. And so when the character who, I mean, so even by revealing the twist, she would not know that her sister is dead, right? We don't have, the audience would know, but the character would still be in the dark on this subject.
Yeah, I think so.
Because when the event happened, she was unaware that her sister was dying.
You know, you kind of get that that twin link premonition sort of
yeah,
turn over the shoulder, still, something's happening.
I feel like it would be really a really interesting exercise in dramatic irony to have this character who's constantly butting heads with the stepmother.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, yeah, she's actually way more of a bitch than you're making her out to be.
Sure.
It's kind of an irreversible, you know, the film Irreversible,
mm-hmm.
sort of my hands are tied. I can't help you, main character, but there's some information you need right. to know.
Totally. Totally. Well, I also think the movie tries to give the stepmother a little bit of redemption. And, you know, it's not until thinking about the beats in the movie and why it does certain things. That my feelings change about this movie the more I think about it and the more time passes since I've seen it. As I see it, it's a exercise in frustration. The whole last, maybe even two thirds of the movie is just, but I want to know what the fuck happened and which of these people are real now. And I'm too in limbo. I don't like this. And, you know, then it all plays out. Her stepmom has a moment of panic, leaves the room, which seems like a pretty bad thing. But all right, mm-hmm. moment of panic. Let's just think about it in writing, not in the way we've already been built to hate the stepmom and assume everything she does is just out of pure evil.
Right.
She leaves that room in panic, gathers her thoughts, turns around to go, I should probably help. Oh man, what am I doing? And then she is blocked by our main character and they have a little spat. And I think, you know, the idea of you're going to regret this in the future or whatever is basically she's saying you can't go back this way. Get the fuck out of the house. Go back downstairs. You don't belong up here. You still want her to push back and you want her to just go, your sister's dying in there. Let's go help her.
Right.
That's what's supposed to happen. But I think the movie does this as a little bit of a way to excuse, to blame their poor relationship for what happens, not to blame the characters. Mm-hmm. It's just like with the twin premonition thing, which by the way, is not a real fucking thing in case anyone was curious, which no one was, but it's not real.
Right.
It's part of the magic of the universe mm-hmm. where you just accept sort of these wide folklore type, you know, the moral of the story, like Bluebeard, right? Where,
right.
where you're going, well, but all these murders and stuff, isn't that it? No. Just pay attention to the thing at the end. It's going to give you a principle that's very important. And I think that's part of what this is going, you know, if their relationship wasn't so bad, then maybe that sister would still be alive. And you're kind of going, well, yeah, but maybe if you just speak up a little bit more instead of like having a bunch of drama in the hallway when somebody's dying over there.
Right.
You're not supposed to look at that part, I don't think. So we're talking about being haunted by visions. Mm-hmm. The crawling girl goes very slow and then fast kind of spook.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was a convention that was very popular for a long time in Asian movies and then eventually in the United States. In a lot of the ways you see, I mean, just as you look through the streak of things that happen in horror movies and how they get scares, I think it's really interesting to look at 3 to 6 year periods and go, what does every horror movie think it needs? And for a while, the United States is just importing fucking right. spooky Japanese ghost movies like no one would believe.
That's where the old school American horror, not a Japanese one. That's what that is.
And isn't that Cabin in the Woods that plays with the idea of, I wish I remember the movie. Just as we were talking about this, I'm thinking with the movie that plays with the idea of you just wind up in a school and there's a bunch of Japanese children doing a spooky thing and like some ghost stuff is going to happen. If anyone has any idea what I'm talking about, it's a double feature show at iCloud.com. So in this movie, and I think this is probably true in a lot of these movies, the ghosts tend to be a little bit metaphorical or they really come from places of, this isn't one spirit haunting the house. This is really the demented kind of memories of these characters.
Mm-hmm.
And that made me really satisfied in the end to see when you get the exact event, learning that one girl is seeing a bunch of stuff and there's a, you know, one of those creepy Asian sacks that they have in these movies. You just hit it with a stick.
Yeah, what the fuck?
I have no idea. And now it's time to talk about the ordeal.
Yeah. So you're going to call it the ordeal. I'm going to call it Calvaire.
I can't pronounce that. There's no hope for that.
All right.
Let's stick to our American roots here.
Yeah.
So this is a Chris Bowen.
Okay.
It was the ordeal that he said we should do and not A Tale of Two Sisters. And you said you'd seen this before.
Yep.
So it's still, this makes me mad that I didn't know about this movie because it's like out of the frying pan into the fucking fire with some of these double features.
Yeah.
It's brutal from the very first exchange, right?
Yeah.
He's leaving and this woman just goes, you know, I'll probably be dead by this time next year, so I guess I won't see you anymore. And please fuck me.
Yeah.
And then basically, never mind, I'll die without it. And then he leaves. This poor character is also trying to get, everyone's trying to bang him from the moment the film starts.
Yeah. Well, and I think that that's a bit of irony that you have this subjectively attractive woman going, hey, maybe we could just have some no strings attached sex. And
but you're talking about the woman at the van,
right?
not the other woman. Not the woman who puts it. Yeah. Well, actually, yeah. If he would have stuck with that woman, he would probably have been in a better situation.
Well, that's what I'm saying is that he goes, no, absolutely not. I have to go be famous. But what he meant was I have to go be gang raped by a town full of inbred men.
And a tiny horse.
And a tiny horse.
Just adding a tiny horse to your gang rape scenes.
Yeah.
Stroke of genius. No pun intended.
I love this movie. I think it's great. It's disgusting. It's so hard to watch. It's heartbreaking and it's bleak. But the scene that punctuates this movie and rockets it into a category different from everything else in its genre is the scene at the place where everybody's hanging out with the piano.
Yeah.
Right after the old man goes, hey, my wife's back.
Uh-huh.
And then he's like, well, anyway, bye, and leaves.
And you go, wow, this is a weird scene for him to just walk into this totally normal tavern and disrupt all these people.
Right.
They must think he's the town weirdo.
What happens right after that? It's a weird dance with a horrendously terrifying piano score.
Yeah.
What it serves to do in the movie is add this level of cultism and kind of premeditation and sort of ritualism to the whole situation. And it darkens it so fast because it's easy. This is going to get weird. It's easy to just write it off. Without this scene, it's easy to go, oh man, that's just a town full of horny rapey guys and they're going to go rape anything. But when you have this ritualistic, organized scene in the tavern, that's not, I mean, it's the kind of thing that, you know, you or I, if we were sitting there, wouldn't be able to just go, oh yeah, let's join in on this one.
Yeah, right.
This is something that they've done or that happens to them, but it's not a normal social global thing that it's not a two-step. It's not, they're not polka-ing.
Yeah. But everyone in the bar is in on it. They're all
right.
I was going to say compliant, but it's not even compliant. They all go, oh good. Yeah. Time for the creepy piano song.
Yeah.
I didn't think this could get a Tale of Two Sisters weird. And that was the scene where I went, oh, all right. Great double feature.
Yeah. I mean, everything else that happens in the movie is still strong and still fucking awful. But that scene predicates the rest of the film in a much weirder way.
Mm.
It's a situation that arises so late. So you're already in, by the time this happens, he's already being forced to dress in the wife's clothing.
I believe there's already a crucifixion.
Right.
Gotta love the casual nature with which the film just delivers just in passing. It's like, oh, what's going on in this barn this afternoon? Oh, a little crucifixion, no big deal. All right, well, I'll see you guys later. I'm going to the tavern. You know what I mean? It's just, you can't, you know, any other, we're talking about all these foreign extreme movies. I mean, I would expect them to build, you know, the American martyrs would end with the crucifixion. It would be, It would be, okay, we're going to slowly torture people. You know, Hostel doesn't just walk by a crucifixion room. Everything leads up to the crucifixion, you know, climax of the movie. And for them to just be wandering around, and this is, you know, it was brutal before because, you know, he had his head shaved. And then in the next scene, it's like, it elevates pretty quickly.
Right.
I guess there's also the part in the middle where the guy goes, you know, if you run away again, I'm going to split you with this fucking axe. Ha ha ha. So I guess that's where we are right about now.
It's definitely the kind of movie that, like Hostel, makes you second guess ever leaving the city you live in.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
It's the kind of, do you get the vibe that this has happened before?
Oh, you mean in the town? Like it's a reoccurring.
Or do you get more of the vibe that this is just what happened to the wife the first time?
Ooh, you know, this isn't something I even thought to bring up, but it is an interesting enough question. We could spend the rest of the show on it. I mean, to think that this town is this weird.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's a town with no women, which I think is particularly noteworthy.
Yeah. And on top of that, this guy just seems so prepared for it, I guess, or maybe, you know, he just has this stuff laying around. It's just kind of second nature. He knows what to do.
Right.
Yeah. It seems like, I mean, everything about the way it's played out says this happens every Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
And everything about
or every Christmas, right?
Right. Right. And, right. It's a present.
Mm-hmm.
It's just gift wrapped, comes to you in a broken down gift wrap van. But everything the movie's actually saying is saying this guy lost his wife and he's sad. And look at this ordeal that happens, you know, as mm-hmm. if it's just this one time in this town. If the history of the town gets written, there's going to be a chapter about this one time this really fucked up thing happened. My gut really says this happens all the fucking time, well, but the so evidence doesn't seem to point to that.
Well, I have evidence that says otherwise. Why would the old man say, don't go down to the town? What happens in the town other than rape? Nothing. Fucking nothing.
There's a death curse. I mean, that could be.
Yeah, I mean, there's the death curse, but they rape the pig when he kind of goes, oh, I'm going to check. Oh, they're raping a pig. Gonna trot away from that.
Yeah, it could just be a town where
I mean, the only thing that happens in town is shit gets fucking raped. That's what happens there.
Yeah, okay. Well, it could be a rapey town. Sure. A weird town where bad stuff happens. But I don't know that it's necessarily a town where your car breaks down and you get turned into somebody's fantasy of their ex-wife, which maybe just doesn't even, she might not have ever even existed. I don't fucking know.
Right.
You know, like this is not 2001 Maniacs. That's what I'm feeling.
Right.
But that's not what I'm feeling. I'm feeling like it totally is. So I don't know.
I definitely feel like throughout the course of the movie, the allusions to the wife are sparse and odd.
Uh-huh.
Whenever the wife gets brought up, everybody knows her.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, it's as if they, what makes you think this went your wife or whatever? It could be said as if they all know he's crazy.
Right.
Yet it could also be said as if, oh, here we go with this again.
Well, that's the thing, right? When he goes to the bar and he goes, hey, my wife's back. The looks he gets aren't, ooh, sweet, something to rape. The looks are, I'm pretty sure we raped that to death a while ago.
Yeah, right.
And he's like, my wife's back, guys. She went missing. I don't know what happened. And they're all like, ooh, this is awkward because we definitely raped his wife to death and then hid her from him.
Well, yeah, they're not reacting as if nobody stands up and goes, oh man, she's back. This is great news. Let's all celebrate.
Right.
They all just look at him. Nobody thinks his wife is actually back.
Right.
And I'm not sure anybody thinks he even had a wife.
Right.
Or that they all know what happened to his wife.
Right. I don't know. There's another thing I want to talk about. And it's the very, very last scene. Uh-huh. In a lot of these movies, this definitely has a rape revenge tone toward the very end.
Mm.
It's really, I mean, it's not the kind of rape revenge with any vindication. It's the kind of rape revenge out of pure necessity and you don't feel like there's any victory.
No.
The very last scene where the guy just kind of dies in the quicksand.
Yeah.
To speak about not really getting revenge. I feel like that is one of the strongest images that I ever take away from this movie.
Mm-hmm.
He's just kind of he's not even running. He's just walking away really hard. Like, yeah. Please stop raping me.
Yeah.
And the king of the rapers is kind of just trotting after him. And eventually he goes, oh fuck, this is quicksand.
One of them, their tar pits.
Yeah. And so the lead guy just turns around and goes, oh, you're dying in the quicksand, huh? And the guy's like, please help me. And he's like, I'm just going to not help you.
Yeah.
It's kind of this thing where you don't feel like he's getting vengeance, but at the same time, there's this dark morality to, I'm not killing you, I'm just not helping you.
Yeah. This seems like another film we've watched recently. Double
right.
Feature. Yeah. Well, then there's also the weird I love you element of right. that's kind of strange.
Yeah.
more than kind of strange, I think. That whole fucking sequence at the end is, man, no one can accuse this movie of not having an ending. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I like a good ending that kind of just goes, and we're done telling this story. So, you know, just go meditate on this. I'll see you later.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a fucking set piece.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you start with the overhead camera spinning around. Please don't rape this guy. All right. Well, too late for that. What's going on with that horse pig thing over there? What's everybody? Somebody's getting shot. And then just in the commotion, he gets away. We follow him, continue following him overhead,
mm-hmm.
and work through this whole. It's the type of thing you plan and, you know, you spend an entire day shooting it. It's just this elaborate sequence. And then getting out, and this could be the, you know, it could be the opening scene of a rape revenge film.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like, or midway through, right? This is the turning point where, but it's not. It's just run through a field or limp or, you know, walked like you were just getting raped. And then you end on this hole in the ground, and then you go through a bunch of trees and the movie's over. It's just such a,
yep.
It's such a, like, the movie does end in a place where it's sort of going and that's it. That's all you get. But it definitely does that after it's had all to say. It's just going, there's no more information for you here.
Right.
Whatever happens at this point doesn't even fucking matter. It's been a bad time. Do you get that? It's been a bad time. You know, we don't know what happens to that guy. We don't really know where he goes or what he does. It's just so fucked what just happened to him that it really doesn't matter. Maybe he dives in headfirst. Maybe he goes to the hospital. Maybe he goes back and fixes his car and lives in the town and helps the
PA. Goes back and fucks the shit out of that nurse.
Could be. Could be. I don't think this guy is having sex again.
Ever again.
Ever.
Do you think he's ever singing for anyone again?
Oh, man.
Do you think that was deflated too in that weird scene?
You know, this is where I get in trouble being a total humanist. And by that, I mean fucking gullible. Is when his, you know, 2001 Maniacs, right? I mean, we've seen this before.
Yeah.
It's there. I'm so glad we're watching this week, actually, because we've been searching for so long of, hey, you know, one of those things where you go to a town and all the people are off and you don't know. That's been another reoccurring theme of this year, is mm-hmm. trying to find a good example of that. And so the examples are just pouring in, you know, today. But he gets there, his car breaks down, and things are a little fishy, but it's actually quite a while before I think, something's going on here.
Right.
I do think
of the time he walks outside and finds him sabotaging his car. You go, hey, that's not fixing it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. See, that's what I mean, is he sits down and has dinner. Obviously, this guy is very, very sad and has some serious misery type plot things going on with him.
Very lonely.
And he wants the guy to stay, and maybe he'll go through some extreme lengths to get his company. We have no idea how far this is going to go or really what he wants. At this point. And then the singing comes in. And when the singing comes in, I go, yeah, this is about to get another level of fucked up. I can feel it coming. But I don't necessarily know that it's going to pile on the way it does. That it's just going to get worse and worse. And I'm amazed how long my guard is down. How long I'm going, well, maybe that part's just missing because he's getting the battery switched out. And well, clearly that was it. That was, don't be suspect of everybody just because they have a beard.
Right.
You know, I'm thinking Tucker and Dale through this whole movie.
Right. Right.
Well, totally. Through the first 7 minutes of this movie. But yeah, it's the moment where he knocks out all the windows and pours gasoline all over the car. I'm going, how's he going to get out of this one?
Right.
There's no, oh, you just saw this from the wrong angle. That's not going to happen here.
You're not going to see an interesting angle toward the end of the movie where John Wayne is just over in the tree line charging the old battery.
Yeah, right. And just needs some gasoline to bridge the connection or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a great move of the movie tonally to not play the mystery spooky score when he gets into the town, or to show a mischievous look on somebody's face where the camera lingers to a sneer as the character walks away.
Like the shot of the cook from The Hunt for Red October.
Yeah, that's exactly. Yes, that is precisely the shot I'm talking about. That is brilliant, brilliant landing on that one. Kudos to you, sir. Yeah, I mean, the movie's not telling you anything. And, you know, you should know, but it leaves open enough room for you to be as in the dark as the character is, or at least to take those steps along with the character. And then once it starts happening, it's still such a, there's almost something more upsetting about the movie not treating it with a Requiem for a Dream score. You know, it's just going, yep, this is kind of happening here. You're just standing outside staring in the window. Probably move away from this cabin, huh? You don't want to be staring in that window too long. Oh, look, here comes some townspeople. I don't want to be here. Get me out of here. I don't know what the end game is, though. I don't know, you know, as each of these things keeps happening, part of me, well, to be honest, what I'm thinking is, but he'll get out somehow. Mm-hmm. They always get out somehow.
Yeah.
And if my brain was a little more active on it, I'd be going, well, how the fuck is he getting out of this?
Right.
And looking for the possible exits, but they're kind of just hopelessly not there at all. I mean, what's he going to do?
Right.
The fact he even gets out the way he does at the end is sort of miraculous. Wow, you really lucked out on that one.
I mean, that's just basically, and that's just saying that good thing you weren't raped to death. That's it. That's right. All we know for certain.
Yeah.
Is that he wasn't raped to death in that scene.
Yeah.
That's all we know.
Yeah, right.
He might have just walked through the tree line and just found another town of rapey dudes and be like, oh, son of a bitch.
Well, it's that great question towards the end where, you know, people walk out of the wrong turn village and they see a road and then everything's just fine. But you're kind of going, well, your car's still fucked. It's kind of exploded. And where do you plan on going? You know, the next truck that picks you up is clearly, man, I could drop another fucking reference in this thing. It's clearly a truck that's going to drive you right back to the town, you know, like that one movie.
Yeah.
So yeah, I really, the more I think about the ending, the more pessimistic I feel about it. I wonder where this comes from why do you make this film? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, there's definitely strong metaphors in here and there's a lot of heavy sexual undertones.
Mm-hmm.
Because it starts with a proposition for maybe categorically unpleasant sex.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a proposition for maybe more pleasant sex, but he's just not into it. And then definitely less pleasant sex.
Right.
Followed by way less pleasant sex.
Right. So always go with door number two is the moral of the story.
Right. Well, I think the moral of the story is just to kind of give you insight into all the different possible ways you can get fucked.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you said that, hey, there's no women in the town.
Yeah.
Also can't help but think that it's very interesting that we have imagine a rape revenge story with a guy. I mean, there aren't a lot of them. They certainly mm-hmm. exist and we've certainly mm-hmm. seen some of them,
mm-hmm.
but they're not vast in number. And especially at the level that this film is playing at, you know, we don't see a woman in the entire town. Really, we stop seeing women once we enter conflict, once we drive away from our last, I don't know, mutually agreeable sexual option. I don't really know what to call it. Our last not a bad time option, civilization. Then it's all just men. And I think there's something, I don't want to say that makes it relatable, but there is something for me as a male viewer when I'm watching a rape revenge film and it's a woman, you're thinking a lot more about what does this say about sexuality? Is it treating it on the surface? Is it really diving deep into something? Is it getting in a character's head? Are we just doing it because this is a type of grindhouse movie and it's just, you know, it's fun to see the revenge? I mean, rape revenge movies operate on so many different levels, wittingly or not. You know, some of them are just deeper films than other films. Mm-hmm. Some of them just play more on the surface. And there's so many different themes that you can play around with in talking about gender treatment, basically just talking about the role of women in films and the argument that people try to have about pornography, you know, is it exploiting women? That's the argument I want to have about rape revenge films.
Right.
Is this exploitational of women? Is this telling us something about a character? You know, these types of things. This film doesn't have any women in it.
Right.
This is as much as I'm ever going to identify with the main character of a rape revenge film as will probably happen. And it puts, you know, I think a male audience in a mindset that maybe they wouldn't be in otherwise.
Totally. Yeah.
I don't know if that's the intention or not. I don't mean to come on here and be like, why does this film exist? What the fuck film? You know, you can make this film just because you wanted to make this film. You don't need a reason. But I look at it, you know, as we're talking about the ending and how bleak it is and how kind of what the fuck, and just going, so this is what, an episode of Trauma? We just wanted to tell the audience what trauma was like. Can I take anything away from this terrible experience, or just, you know, cross that town off the map and maybe take a different route next time? We have a website. It's doublefeature.fm. Email address is doublefeatureshow@icloud.com. Didn't I ask for a something on the show? Oh, the movie that makes fun of the Asian, I want to say somebody is just like teleported into a room and they see a bunch of spooky ghost stuff happening and they know they're in one of those movies. God, I want to say it's Cabin in the Woods, but I don't think it is. Anyways, doublefeatureshow@icloud.com. I've watched this movie with you. There's no chance that you haven't also seen this movie.
No, I know. I've seen so many movies in my life, man.
Fuck you. Who are the producers of the show? They're Jonathan Radke, Eric Tauchek, Aaron Shore, Debbie Starin, and Lexi Love. Maybe one of them will know. Okay, I'm going to fire another question at you. You better know this one.
Okay, I've got it.
Or you're just completely useless and I'm leaving.
Okay.
What are we doing next time?
Well, I don't know. Watch more fucking film.
Yes, you do know.
Sorry.
Look at the schedule. Didn't you contribute to the Kickstarter? Don't you have the schedule?
So next time...
You're one of those no spoiler people, aren't you?
I am. Next time we're doing a wacky musical double feature. That's the best way to put it. It's about insanity through lyric. It's about disharmony and harmony at the same time. It's
about give us a fucking break. Look at the two films we just watched. that's the theme of the double feature.
We're going to cover Phantom of the Paradise, which is a movie that we actually have talked about once on double feature before and you didn't know about it. And then we're going to, it's a really bizarre 70s retelling of Phantom of the Opera. It's kind of cool.
It's kind of fucking awesome. I'm actually really excited to talk about that again.
Yeah. And then we're pairing that with Forbidden Zone, which is it's absolutely insane. So it's, is it Richard Elfman? Yes, Richard Elfman.
You wanted to just make up an Elfman, didn't you?
Danny Elfman's brother. But Richard Elfman wrote, directed this movie about, I don't really know. It's insane. And Danny Elfman plays Satan.
So show up next time to see if Michael has any better clue what this movie's about, or if we basically already covered the next episode.
All right. Watch more fucking film.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.